Hello, and welcome to The Ascent. I'm Karen Falcon, Performance and Development Lead at Tenzing. We're a private equity firm passionate about the human stories between high-growth businesses and teams. Guy, the co-founder of Tenzing, and I talk to some of the most driven and insightful founders, CEOs, and high performers. Previous series have focused on the tech world, and now we're looking beyond. We talk through the highs, the lows, and everything in between. We're diving deep into what fuels them, how they build standout teams, and keep pushing boundaries. No topic is off limit, and every conversation is packed with lessons that you can apply to your own journey. Today, I'm joined by Tom Witcher, co-founder of Dr. Doctor, a digital health platform transforming the way hospitals manage outpatient care. Originally trained as an engineer and later a management consultant, Tom spotted a simple but powerful problem. Missed hospital appointments were wasting time, money, and resources. So he co-built Dr. Doctor, a smart, patient-focused system that helps NHS hospitals digitize bookings, reduce no-shows, and give patients more control over their care. We talk about innovation in healthcare, the challenges and opportunities of scaling behavior change tech, and what it takes to build solutions that actually stick. A great chat with a true health tech pioneer. Okay, hi, Tom Witcher. You are CEO and founder of Dr. Doctor, which is a platform which helps clinics move to a hybrid model, removing administration and unnecessary face-to-face appointments from the NHS. What does that mean?
Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You are very welcome.
What does that mean? Great question. Well, fundamentally, the way that we've been doing healthcare for the last 200, 300, 400 years hasn't changed. If you go to Guy's Hospital in central London, there's a stone bench, which Thomas Guy put there in the 1600s. And when people go to hospitals, they still sit on benches and wait. And Dr. Doctor's all about shifting that model. So moving to a model where you're only seen face-to-face when you really need to be. And the rest of the time, we can do it online using digital tools. So you get a better experience and doctors can be much more efficient as well.
Where did that start?
Well, many moons ago.
Yes. Only 12. Maybe other bits started before that.
Yeah.
That got me to that.
I mean, so I'm not a medic, right? I'm a ship scientist of all things. And like many ship scientists, I finished my degree and I didn't really know what I wanted to be. You know, it's there's not many people that end up as yacht designers. And the ones that do tend to either be really smart or start with quite a lot of money beforehand. And so I did various things. I spent a year as a preparateur for the Soledad de Figaro race. I worked in a chandlery in Bristol for a bit called Wet and Windy.
Yes, the best.
Which was fantastic. And then I actually went and worked for my dad in an engineering company for a bit and started like using my engineering degree, doing process engineering. And that was fun and it kind of made me realize what a real job looked like. And then I went and worked for a company called Newton Europe. Newton is a process improvement consultancy. And we used to do all of our work on a no-win, no-fee basis. So come to your factory, have a look at it, talk to the people, eye up the machines, and then rather than saying you should change these things, go and change it for them, measure the results. So you'd be on the shop floor in the morning and the boardroom in the afternoon. Brilliant fun. So much fun.
Yeah.
Met some people who are like still really good friends of mine to this day and met my two co-founders. So I was doing mostly fast-moving consumer goods, making things, chopping onions. I literally met my co-founder in an onion chopping factory in Bedfordshire.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was, you'd sort of finish your day and you'd go and have a shower in it and it smelled like, you know, a kebab shop.
Yeah.
And then they sent me to go and do a project in a hospital in the Midlands. And I did not want to do that at all. Healthcare was messy. It was boring. It was slow. I was an engineer. I wasn't interested at all. But as soon as I got under the skin of healthcare, I discovered how fascinating it is. I discovered this kind of interplay between people and process that you don't get in the same way anywhere else. And I also discovered how broken the system was. So I spent a lot of time in outpatient clinics watching what the doctors were doing and watching what the patients were doing, trying to sort of improve the financial efficiency of those organizations. But the fundamentals were broken. So this is sort of, I guess, 2011. I'd just got an iPhone. iPhone comes out in like 2007. Paul Campbell-Jones had the first iPhone.
Trendsetter amongst us.
Exactly. I remember thinking how cool it was. I'd just got mine and I was thinking, you can do all sorts of things on these. Like, you know, this is surely this is going to change healthcare. Hospitals were so far away from being able to even consider that. You know, you literally had patients turning up with five or six different letters printed A4 letters, we still get them, right? Rubbish. With different dates and times, confused about why they were meant to be there, sometimes to be told they'd missed their appointment and they'd been sent back to their GP and they were angry because they'd been waiting months or distressed. So we thought, let's try and solve this. Let's try and build what we thought was going to be an app, and we can talk about the fact that it didn't end up as an app, to allow patients to manage their outpatient appointments in hospitals. It was sort of a night in a pub, a picnic in Windsor Great Park with Bellinis. And then we pitched it to a startup accelerator called Bethnal Green Ventures. Mm-hmm. And from there, Dr. Doctor was born.
Yes. You say you met your co-founders. Obviously, when you met them, you didn't know necessarily you'd be co-founders.
Yeah.
What was it that brought you together to bring Dr. Doctor to life?
Yeah, it's a great question, that, because we weren't best friends. Mm-hmm. We were colleagues and we really liked each other, but we weren't best friends. And I actually think that turned out to be a real positive, because we're three quite different people in many ways. And there's a lot of luck in choosing a co-founder, right? Like, if you start a business with someone, you're almost more tied in than if you marry them in many ways. And I think, you know, if someone had said to the three of us individually, you know, in 2012, you're going to spend the next 12 years of your life, you know, fighting and crying and you know, going through all these life events with these two others, we'd probably all have gone, oh, are we? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But as I said, so Rinesh and I met chopping onions in a factory and we got on. We're very different humans. Mm-hmm. I'm an extrovert. He's an introvert. He's incredibly structured. I'm a bit more lackadaisical. But the combination seemed to work.
Yeah.
And then Perrin happened to be doing a project with me in one of the hospitals. He's a real tech guy. So he's our CTO. Mm-hmm. Slightly different background, you know, computer scientist. So he was doing tech at Newton rather than pure consultancy. And again, sort of slightly different personality type. Mm-hmm. But there was something about the three of us that felt like we would make a really, really awesome team. And I think we all felt that. Mm-hmm. And the way it's tended to be is I pitched the ideas and I don't think it was my idea. I'm not going to claim that. Mm-hmm. But I think I brought the energy to those first few meetings. Rinesh brings the structure and the sort of challenge and the rigor. And then Perrin is what makes it happen.
Yes.
And that's worked really fantastically for us. And having a triangle is a powerful thing as well. I think co-founder dynamics are one of the biggest challenges for almost all organizations.
Yeah.
And particularly in startups, you can almost tell if a startup is going to succeed or fail based on the dynamic between those people. And I think when there's three of you, it's much, much easier to sort of resolve conflict, but also to deal with the ups and downs, because entrepreneurship is a hell of a roller coaster, right? It's the one thing I say to people. It seems really exciting to start your own business, but be prepared to live your life in ups and downs, which just, you know, completely wipe out everything else. And having three of you means that there's always one that's on the up and there's probably one that's on the down and you can support each other.
Yeah, fascinating. And so as that, you know, you talked about the various qualities, characteristics, preferences of the three of you, you get an idea, you start pitching it, you realize you've got something that's going to happen. You're going to need to start really working together rather than having picnics. Although maybe you still have a lot of picnics. I don't know. But, you know, you're going to have to start maybe bringing more people in. Mm-hmm. So how did you start bringing people in to that vision and reality that you three were starting to bring to life?
Yeah. So there's sort of two parts of bringing people in. I think there's bringing in new team members, but actually bringing in clients.
Yeah.
And certainly in our space, which is health tech, you know, our key customer are big, large teaching hospitals, right? So these are organizations that employ 15,000 people, that have £1 billion of spend and all sorts of different people within them. And so much of the way that we've managed to achieve commercial success, I think, is also about how we've brought the people in.
Yeah.
But in terms of bringing people into our team, so it was just the three of us for probably a year. And when we started the accelerator, we were laughed at because we were the only people who didn't write any code in those 3 months.
Yeah.
We didn't write any code, but we did loads of investigating and experimenting and learning. And it was through that learning that we ended up building a product that was initially on text messaging and not an app. And we can talk more about that. But we did need to hire some people. We needed to begin to write some code and we needed to scale it. And those first couple of hires, I think the cultural fit is the most important thing. We were incredibly lucky. So the first two people we hired, one of them still works for us.
Yeah.
12 years later. Mm-hmm. The other one only stopped working for us because him and his family moved to LA, and he continued to work for us from LA for a number of years. And only in the last couple of years has he gone, it's too much.
Yeah.
And his name was Steve. And I knew Steve was going to fit in when we said, we didn't have an office. We said, we're going to interview you at the British Library. Mm-hmm. We did lots of our early work at the British Library. So Steve's like, okay, yeah, no, I'll come to the British Library. And he turned up 40 minutes late, having gone to the British Museum to find the three of us had given up on him and were having ice creams.
Yes.
And we said, well, do you want an ice cream? And he went, yeah, fine, I'll have an ice cream. And we ended up sort of interviewing him over a Mr. Whippy on a table outside of the British Library.
Incredible.
And I thought, you know what, this guy's going to fit in.
Yeah.
And he'd worked at ASOS. He was a really talented technical developer. But what he shared was a willingness to get stuck in, not to be afraid of new problems, having that curiosity.
Yeah.
And he was kind and he had a sense of humor. And I think when you're making those early hires, you have to think about, as a founding team, you're a system, right? You're a system of people who've have found a way to work together. Every time you add somebody new to that system, it's a new system. It's not that you bring someone into it. You have to think, instead of three of you, now there's four of you. And that is really very different. And you basically have to start again. And we decided to optimize for people who we thought would accept the way that we worked and would sort of bring new skills, but wouldn't require us to necessarily hugely change our culture.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then the other thing we really looked for were people who are driven by the mission. Mm-hmm. I think if you're at those early stages of a startup, for us, it was impact. And we are an impact business. We have impact written into our sort of shareholders agreements. When we start our board meetings, we start with our impact measures. And that's what gets me out of bed every day. It's like, wow, we have helped 135 million people appointments be booked in the NHS. That's the thing that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think that we have such longevity of team members is that they really care about what we're doing and the mission. Mm-hmm. Like, actually care about it. It's not a sort of mission statement on a wall somewhere. It's a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really key, that your first probably even sort of 10 or 15 people are so bought into that mission.
And through that, evolving the narrative, but repeating the mission, you know, your narrative around that mission will change as you work with 20 million, as you work with 100 million, you know. And again, you know, you talk about each individual early on, but the three of you co-founders are very central. You have an ice cream with them, you know. As time goes on, the three of you become, you're possibly not as close to the interview process as you were. So how have you made sure that culture, which the three of you are still proud of, part of, you know, really passionate about, how do you ensure that spreads as you get more and more people?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm a huge believer in culture. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that expression that culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
Like 100% buy into that. And we did interview everyone for the first few years.
Yeah.
But very early on, we started bringing other team members into the interview process.
Okay.
So I think that's important, is actually not holding it too tight. Mm-hmm. And we still do that today. So if we're hiring an engineer, there will be engineers of that level involved in that interview process. And that's probably not that unusual, but I think that's really important for buy-in on both sides.
Yeah,
I think culture only works if you really live it. Mm-hmm. You can write it down and you should write it down and you should think hard about it. But it's the things that you do which really instill it in teams.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of our cultural things is compassion. Mm-hmm. When we first started, we had a very short and snappy cultural statement, which was quite sweary.
Okay.
Am I allowed to be sweary?
Yeah, you go for it. Depends on the swear words they're talking about.
Yeah, I know. You know, there's obviously some which are banned.
Yeah, so you go for it.
And it was, get shit done, don't be a dick.
Yeah.
That was our cultural statement. Mm-hmm. And we had that on the wall in our offices for quite a long time. We've changed it now to be bold, have compassion and aim high, which I love.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite have the same ring. And we often still refer to the older one.
Yeah.
But the second part of that, you know, which is to have compassion and be kind and don't be a dick, you have to live that if you want your teams to live it.
Yeah.
And actually you have to do things which make it real, like make hard decisions, which make that real. So I think that's everything from the way you treat people when they have personal crises in their life. So that's the big thing that no one tells you about being a founder or a CEO, is everybody's life stuff is your life stuff.
Yeah.
And how you decide to treat people sort of resonates in your culture forever. So how you treat people, like, you know, having, it's not just having policies, but actually like what's the spirit of the way that you want to treat employees, but also the way that you treat customers.
Yeah.
And we have lots of examples where we've decided to make what are objectively poor commercial decisions in the micro, which are great cultural decisions in the macro, because our team members see that we are doing great things. So real life example, COVID pandemic hits and lots of people in various parts of health made a lot of money from the COVID pandemic. And I actually don't remember doing this, but I apparently stood up in front of our team and said, we're going to help our organizations transition here and we're not going to profit from this. It's really important. And one of our senior developers who was around then sent me a note literally yesterday saying, I've just watched back the All Hands from last week. Thanks for your consistent compassion. I still remember what you said during COVID. That inspired me to go and build Broadcast Message, which is a tool we still use today. Mm-hmm. And he built pretty much on his own in 2 weeks of late nights.
Yeah.
So that sort of statement of we are going to live true to our values then resonates on 5 years later and actually resulted in an amazing product and a really bought in employee.
Yeah.
So it's those things that I think show what culture is. And if you're always demonstrating culture, then people take it all the way through with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, if you can write down as much as you want, but people will see what is lived.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll see the behaviours.
Yeah.
The thing I find quite exciting here is when new people join, I say the culture is for you to shape, you know, and each individual can make a huge difference.
Yes.
You know, they can really add to it. They can detract from it as well. But the clearer you make your behaviours that create the team, which for you hums and lives what you want to live.
Yeah.
They start to see very quickly if it's the right behaviours or not.
Yeah, they do. And one person can make a huge difference.
Yeah.
They really can. And we went through a really difficult cultural phase post-COVID.
Yes.
I think a lot of people did, right? You know, it was kind of hybrid working and people were quite burnt out. And we ended up having a bit of a moaning culture in one of our teams. And once you have that, it's really, really hard to break it.
Yeah.
And extremely frustrating, actually, as a leader, because can't tell someone not to moan. That doesn't work. And you can try and listen and you can try and sort of act on some of those moans, but it can become a bit of a self-fulfilling thing. Mm-hmm. And we actually ended up having to ask some people to leave the organization. Mm. And I've noticed that as well. That's the other big cultural thing is I talk a lot about compassion. Compassion doesn't just mean be nice.
Yes.
It means, you know, give really good structured feedback at the right time.
Yes.
Pick someone up on a poor behavior. And sometimes it means asking someone to leave because the system needs everybody to be bought into it. And it doesn't take much to begin to destroy that.
Yeah. And do you and your two co-founders align on, you know, do you get together for those decisions or does one of you take kind of the lead on those things?
We still make lots of decisions together. So the other really interesting point here actually is, so for years, the three of us were incredibly tight unit. And actually, that began to be a problem because we became the founders with like a big F.
Yes.
You know, and you almost have this sort of Jesus complex going on in the organization where everyone looks to you to solve everything for them.
Yeah.
And it's easier, particularly if you're used to kind of working in a smaller team and the team's got bigger, it's easy to say something in an offhand way and for that to be interpreted as an instruction. And I fell foul of that quite a lot. You know, I'd go and join a product strategy jam and say something and my sort of interested comment would be taken as, okay, we need to change direction. And they'd spend the next month changing all of their plans based on what I thought was something which was throwaway.
Yes.
And that's super dangerous, I think, in organizations. So giving people the psychological safety to challenge, but also making it really, really clear that they have autonomy.
Yeah.
And when I'm inputting versus when I am being directive, because you do need to do that too, is really vital.
Yeah.
And then to your point about sort of that decision-making, so the other thing that we really struggled with was building an executive team. And that was because we had three really strong founders. So you bring somebody new into that and they're not a founder and they've kind of got their own ideas and probably we think, oh, we've tried that before and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Or we really failed to hire C-level execs again and again and again. And we couldn't work out why. And sometimes it was them and more often it was us, I think. And we only cracked that in the last couple of years.
Great.
through having to be very strict with ourselves.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. There's an author, Adam Grant, and something that really stuck, probably because it's geographical, but organizations or teams, you've got an archaeology, you know, you've got what's gone before. That's really important, but it can also weigh you down.
Yep.
You've got the geography, which is where you currently are and also what is in front. And then you've got your North Star, what's guiding you. You've got that astrology. And that's always stuck with me for, we tried it, it didn't work. And my favorite thing is then.
Yes.
Let me try.
Yes.
You know, and it's exactly, but you need it two ways because you need people to be aware of how long or how deep is that archaeology, you know, and are we actually living in the geography and looking around us, or are we holding ourselves back by what might have been?
Yes.
And that alignment to that North Star allows that autonomy. But again, as you say, you have to do some stepping back to allow other people to step in.
Exactly.
It sounds like you've got to.
Oh, we have, but through hard work.
Yeah.
Particularly when there's sort of, there's 12 years of that.
Absolutely.
History.
Yeah, it's big.
You know, and we tried it before, is still a bit of a problem, whether it's with organizational design or whether it's with product.
Okay.
It's actually like, so the example of we didn't build an app was absolutely the right thing in 2012.
Yes.
In 2025, consumer behavior has changed and you expect to have multiple apps on your phone to do things. And we still don't have an app and that's still the right decision. But that being challenged on a regular basis is really, really important. And that can be difficult when you have limited resource. And I would have done that. Don't even bother looking at it.
Yeah.
So knowing when to empower people and having this sort of self-awareness to be able to go, all right, give it a go.
Yeah.
Prove it to me one way or another is important. And we've got there, but it's still an uneasy process, I think, sometimes.
Yes. Well, and also you, as you know, as the company grows, as the team grows, you have to very deliberately reinvent yourself within the same job title. Your career progression is, I don't know what comes next, you know. So you think, well, that's not going to necessarily, of course, there's something in there, but it's your personal development within that same position.
Yeah.
Which is key. And you have to reinvent, redefine. What does a CEO of 50 people mean? It's very different to 100, different to 150. CEO in 2012, very different to a CEO in 2025.
Yes.
So how have you gone about some of that reinventing of yourself?
The reinvention is absolutely right. The job is utterly different in every way.
Yeah.
So what it was. Interestingly, I have been CEO now for quite a long time. For the first few years, we didn't have any job titles. Mm-hmm. We just were sort of, you know,
starting up,
doing the things. Yeah. And that was kind of fun. And that worked brilliantly. It was really hard to transition from three people who were just fluid to one of us being the CEO. Really hard. And that took longer than I appreciated to get right for all of us. It works really well now. The reinvention stuff, I think this is true for all roles in startups, actually. But I think having a curious, growth-minded mindset is the number one predicate for success, like without a shadow of a doubt. And it's what I look for in every single interview, is this person curious?
Yes.
If they're curious, they're going to learn and they're going to develop and they're going to change.
Yeah.
And if they're not, and they're a little bit static in their thinking, they're probably going to suffer when you give them feedback. They're probably not going to necessarily adapt to the world, which is more volatile now than it has ever been, right?
Yeah,
if you ever needed to better deal with,
yes.
there's VUCA, isn't it? Which
is,
you know, the VUCA is crazy right now.
Yes.
So that kind of flexible mind is the key thing. And for me, I think there's a couple of different facets to it.
Yeah.
So the number one is being humble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know the answer to everything. Like that is absolutely key.
Yeah.
If you think you know the answers, you're already in a fixed mindset. So listening to others, consulting, like just generally listening, actually, you know, whether it's recruiting, whether it's sales, whether it's product development, listening is the most underrated skill, in my opinion, by a million miles.
Yeah.
Listen and learn. Have strong opinions when you need them.
Mm-hmm.
But the more open your eyes and ears can be, the more you're going to learn from the environment around you. So,
that's
one.
Mm-hmm.
I personally took an approach of every time we had to do something new, I would go and buy the book.
Okay.
So I would go and we had to build a marketing team. I'd be like, all right, I don't know anything about marketing. Go on Amazon, buy the top couple of books, read them, skim read them, summarize them, but give myself a bit of a framework for what good looks like before I started trying to recruit or interview agencies or any of those things. Because the cool thing about living in 2025 is that there is knowledge everywhere.
Yes.
And if you're not leveraging all of that knowledge, then, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice. And, you know, we were sort of giggling about ChatGPT earlier, but actually you can go on ChatGPT and you can say, can you summarize to me, you know, 4 or 5 marketing frameworks? Mm-hmm. And it will give you that. Or can you summarize the NHS 10-year plan and give me, you know, an insight into that? So actually research is easier than it's ever been.
Yeah.
So that was always my first thing, is I'd go and buy the book. But these days, probably also use all of the various mm-hmm. online tools to give yourself enough knowledge to be dangerous. And enough knowledge to be dangerous is a good place to be.
Yeah.
You shouldn't then try and execute it all yourself, mm-hmm. but it's enough that you can go and challenge and look at things. So there's those. And then the last one, I think, is coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't work with a coach in the first few years, but went through quite a lot of accelerators. So startup accelerators, where you got essentially mentoring from people. And that was golden for us. I mean, just to sort of laugh, we turned up at, we got free space in Google Campus when we started our business.
Mm-hmm.
And we left our jobs in consulting literally on the Friday and went to work on the Monday. And we turned up on the Monday in jackets and shirts
mm-hmm.
in Google Campus. And just looked like lemons, you know, complete and utter lemons.
Did you arrive by pogo stick and scooter?
We should have scooted in.
You should have. That might have done your clothing grade a bit better.
And I've got a photo of the three of us on that day, and it's really, really funny looking at it. I think we've aged quite well.
Okay.
Looking at that photograph. Very, very goony, kind of three enthusiastic guys. But yeah, the mentoring we got on what it means to be a startup and to mm-hmm. iterate and be agile in that time was massive.
Yeah.
But then I started working with a coach probably 6 or 7 years ago. And I'd been wanting to work with a coach for a while. I was sort of struggling with, as you say, moving through the gears. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was hitting plateaus. And also because of the emotional roller coaster, sometimes finding it really hard, mm-hmm. you know, getting into a dark place.
Yeah.
And feeling like this was impossible and it was too much. And that is the thing about entrepreneurship. There will be days where you feel like that. Be days like you feel like you're king of the world as well.
Yes.
But they often sort of come quite quickly after each other. And I was super lucky to find someone who I've worked with ever since called Sam Axtell, who I met on the back of a boat.
Amazing.
So I was sat on the back of a Fast 40 with a bunch of boys from Woodlands Way.
Yes.
having a great time.
Obviously.
And she was the owner's guest.
Yes.
And I sort of was sitting on the back corner chatting, which is what I'm best at when it comes to sailing.
Yep.
And it turns out that she had recently qualified as a coach and had a really interesting background.
Yeah.
And so we started working together. And she completely changed the game for me. Completely changed the game. We still see each other sort of every 6 to 12 weeks, depending on the intensity requirement. I often come out of those sessions feeling like I've done sort of 6 rounds with Mike Tyson, mentally speaking. But she challenges, she brings, you know, thoughtful, constructive things into my awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have been able to succeed without that person in my life. I think more than anything, for me anyway, coaching does 2 things. It keeps you sort of honest to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of takes you out of your unconscious competence state mm-hmm. and into that conscious unconsciousness.
Yes.
Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yes.
It basically makes you aware of the things that you should be doing.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that Sam says most often to me is, have you asked them?
Yes.
Or, you know, it's just whatever it is you're worrying about, why didn't you talk to that person? Or and I think that is absolutely huge. So for me, that's how you create that growth mindset. Listen, be curious and be humble. Read and take advantage of the fact that all of the world's information is available to you so quickly.
Yeah.
And then work with someone, you know, almost doesn't matter who it is. Sometimes we get our engineers to rub a duck, you know, talk to a rubber duck.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that can be enough.
Yes.
But ideally a human. yes. Or an AI maybe in 2025. And keep doing those things because it's like the gym.
Yeah.
You know, when you stop doing it,
mm-hmm.
you go backwards. Your brain is a muscle.
Yeah.
And you can tell the people that bother with the mental gym and the people that don't.
Yeah. And I guess implicit in that is then the drive to go and do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, you want those people, the curiosity has to be matched up with a bit of rocket fire.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Let's go.
Yeah.
One of my favourite sayings, let's go. You know, we've got this. Yeah, so
and
go for it.
I was going to say with the let's go, because 100%, right?
Yeah.
Like you can tell the difference between someone who wants it and is going to go out there and make something happen and the person who's not really bothered and is quite comfortable. It's so obvious. And the other thing I think that goes with that is bravery.
Yeah.
And I sometimes call it walking through doors. So many of the things that have happened for us have been because of being willing to walk through a door you're not sure about.
Yes.
And I once had someone say to me, Tom, you're incredibly lucky. Mm. And I don't believe in luck, but I do believe in putting yourself in positions where you can take advantage of the situation. Yeah. And that means everything from being willing to go and talk to someone really senior for the first time, which can feel really scary, mm-hmm. within your organization or outside of your organization.
Yeah.
You know, break the hierarchy. It could mean taking on a project that you're a bit afraid of.
Yes.
You know, when I was doing more sailing, I was sailing on sort of 40-foot boats, mm-hmm. with lots of our friends, and the navigator on a big super yacht got sick.
Yes.
And Andy Green called me up and said, we haven't got anyone. Will you come out? Will you jump on a plane and come and do this on 150-footer, mm-hmm. with, you know, a bunch of America's Cup sailors when you're 25?
Yeah.
And it's saying yes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I know how to do this. Yes. But okay, I'm going to come and do it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to work really hard when I'm here.
Absolutely.
And that's how you create luck. And I think the same thing is true with the Let's Do It. Like, yeah. you, whether it's a programmer who's scared of a piece of the code base, mm-hmm. and so they don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
Or whether it's a salesperson who doesn't want to make that extra call to someone senior, they just call the people that they're comfortable talking to.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of bravery, the willingness to walk through the door.
Yeah.
You often find once you're through it that you blossom.
Yeah.
And that's a huge predicator for success
or
as well.
You've stepped in, maybe done a dance, and you've left the room again.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's okay.
But you've learned something.
Exactly.
And, you know, the Americans love to talk about safe to fail,
yeah.
right? Safe to fail. And actually, the first startup event I went to when I was still consulting was an event called Failboat.
Okay.
And Failboat was, I got the train, I was doing this job in the Midlands, and I got the train down, went to the conference, stayed in a skanky hotel room, and then went back up, you know.
Yeah.
And I came back so inspired.
Yeah.
And it was the founder of Love Film.
Okay.
Who had failed because he didn't create Netflix.
Yeah.
It was two guys who started Airbnb, but in the UK.
Okay.
Right? Same idea, same time. Yeah. They got acquired by Airbnb.
Yeah, okay.
So they did all right.
Yeah.
But they didn't start Airbnb.
Nope.
And then a whole bunch of other people that had done things that had, for various reasons, hit the rocks and it had gone wrong. And watching these people, this is in like 2011, right? Stand up on a stage and talk about, some of them were really successful, right? Mm-hmm. But had just missed the fact that they had the honesty,
yes.
to talk like that.
Yeah.
Walk through the door, as you say, do the dance.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter.
Yes.
But you've come back so much richer and yeah. having learned. And I think that the more we do that in our lives, the richer our lives are and the more rounded and successful we become as people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that... Yeah, you can see the let's go. You can see the door grabbers. And sometimes the door makers. You know, you've got to be in the right place so that when a door is coming posh, like, that's mine.
Yeah.
That's mine. And exactly. That sometimes, is it luck? Is it, you've got to be there and ready to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have read those books or spoken to those people. That means that when that door comes posh, you're like, hello.
Exactly.
It's not a wind shift that you might be on totally the wrong side
yeah.
for. You know, it's there and you're like, right, I'm through that.
Yeah.
So there's that positioning of yourself so that when it presents, you're going to do your best through it.
Exactly.
And that part that you also can go through it.
Yeah.
Which is, pretty cool.
Which is everything. With that, though, mm-hmm. comes something which I'm very passionate about, which is, I think, you know, we sort of have this idea of hustle culture at all costs.
Yep.
And actually, I think that can be really dangerous, mm-hmm. because walking through doors doesn't mean take, take, take.
No.
And you see that, I think it's, you know, if you, lots of this kind of the TikTok stuff and things on social media, it's all about hustle and it's all about, you know, but actually, if all you do is ever take, mm-hmm. those people don't succeed.
Yeah.
And you see it particularly in networking events. Mm-hmm. So you go to a networking event and there'll be someone there who is, they're usually young, not always, usually young, driven, talking to everyone in the room, really impressive, but they're taking from everybody. Mm-hmm. And they stand in front of someone and the first thing they do is they pitch.
Yeah.
And if you do that and the first thing you do is you pitch, you immediately switch the other person off. Mm-hmm. And successful networkers are the people who give first.
Yeah.
Can you give everybody in that room something that's useful to them, that's new to them, and you make a new connection? And if you do that, then those people will help you back. And it's the same with all of these opportunities, is if you go into it with a, this is a 1+1 situation, you'll create new value.
Yeah.
If you go into it with a, I'm going to take something out of this, you may, in the sort of in that instance, you might come out feeling like you've succeeded, but that doesn't work over the long term. And I think that's really, really important if you want to build sustainable organizations, is to always think of it as a 1+1. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah, absolutely. And then again, that also goes back into our workplace.
Mm.
You know, of how much are we asking, how much are people giving?
Yeah.
What makes, and also along with that is thinking it is two-way, and it is also about, it goes almost back to that culture piece. What's the culture you're creating, which makes people happy to give, but also allows them to feel like they are being given to as well.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got that relationship internally as well.
100%. Like sort of helping a colleague out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really struggling with this problem. Can you help me? Again, actually, it's really interesting as we talk about it. I think about the high performers in Dr. Doctor, and they're the people who are always, they're helping out with a bid or someone stuck with a bit of code, and they're there pair programming with them.
Yeah.
Those people who give become really successful within organizations because everyone recognizes them as contributors. But they then have that network that they can draw on when they have a problem. So I absolutely think it's true internally.
Yeah, interesting. And it creates a space where all those people, I guess, can take more risks as well.
Mm.
Because they've got maybe a bit more, not bandwidth, but they've accrued some space to be forgiven.
Yes.
You know, they're happy to give the time, they're happy to give their expertise, they're happy to give support.
Yeah.
And then it often comes back.
Exactly. It's cultural capital.
Exactly.
Ultimately. And good organizations, well, we're all human and we all run on cultural capital at the end of the day. And I think you can role model that as a leader.
Yes. Yeah.
Giving people time
is
a really important thing. And that don't be a dick bit, you know, like give feedback, give it compassionately. Don't take someone down in a meeting because you're feeling angry that day. Mm-hmm. The other big thing that I think plays into this is taking credit.
Yes.
And, you know, I think when you look at great leaders, they give the credit to the people around them always. They don't take the credit. Again, it's all linked to this kind of, are we working as a team or are we working as individuals?
Yeah.
And if you're there taking the credit for the work that's been done, you are not a team. You're an individual. And it's not an effective way to work. And it's also not a fun way to be.
Yes.
And I think that is like really, really important because like I said, whether it's with co-founders or colleagues, you spend more time with them than your family.
Yeah.
You may as well have fun while you're doing it. And like, I think fun people are more productive personally, but
yeah,
I guess that's a...
I'll align with you then. So, you know, we've talked a lot about that compassion side. We've talked a lot about, you know, that desire to be curious, to learn, to kind of reinvent. You've also had times where, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times about the app that you haven't yet done. You know, you've gone down a different route. You've talked also about as you bring more people in at every level, you want people to challenge, you know, and I guess that challenge is disrupt us, challenge us. Yes. What are we missing?
Yeah.
Why is that so important for you?
So the challenge point, I think, is critical in organizations that want to innovate and scale. And one of the things that has made me a successful entrepreneur, but is also a challenge for me, is that I love change.
Yeah.
I love change. Mm-hmm. And I'm super comfortable with ambiguity.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost my happiest place.
Yes.
Is really ambiguous situation where we have to make uncertain decisions. That's like, for me, that's interesting. And sometimes that can be really disruptive in a CEO.
Yeah. Yes.
If your preference is to always change things, that isn't really a very good scaling technique. But sort of like we mentioned earlier, like, I don't think any organization in 2025 can afford to be static for any length of time. And if you do hire really great people and you don't allow them to challenge the way that you work or the things that you're building, or even to an extent your values, then why are you hiring great people? You're wasting their talent. So for me, you know, we make a great effort to make sure we have really world-class people who work for us.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to them and adapting our organization based on what they're saying is really critical. And if you take our products and our market, so in 2012, when we started, the thought of putting patient information online was balmy.
Okay.
Like, nobody was doing it. And I literally got laughed at by IT directors of hospitals.
Yeah.
You can't put patient information online. That's illegal.
Yes.
Like, literally, that is illegal.
Yeah.
And we were the first people to connect the NHS's private data network up with the public internet. And to do that, we basically had to almost break a few rules.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not quite, but it was right on the edge of like what was allowed.
Yes.
We had to buy a physical computer in a physical place that was our network server. You know, there's no spinning up of like cloud compute. And then we had to go and challenge the information governance people, you know, the people, the lawyers that look after patient data. We had to go and get the rules changed in order to do what we were doing in 2012. And the core of our product then was about patient engagement. So sending a text message to make sure people turn up for their appointments. And we still send 200 million text messages a year. So we send a lot of text messages. But our value proposition has moved from that to solving the problem of supply and demand by removing face-to-face appointments. So we've changed. Our mission is the same.
Yes.
You know, help patients get access to great care.
Yeah.
But the way we're doing it is really, really different. So if you can't continue to evolve, you're not going to do that. And then to my point of the patient information, so 2012, nobody was doing it. So we create a market with, you know, we put some smaller hospitals live. And then in 2016, we get Guy's and St. Thomas, biggest, arguably the most famous teaching trust in the country. They would certainly say so. I'd probably agree with them. And at that point, a little bit backwards in their technology, it's fair to say. And we proved the value of what we were doing in a small number of clinics. And off the back of that, the chief medical officer, Ian Abbs, who's now the CMO, took a big bet to scale our product across the whole of Guy's and St. Thomas. We were like 15 people at that point. This was like, this is a crazy thing. So suddenly we've got this massive famous teaching trust doing this thing that a few years ago had been illegal. Really successful project. That was almost the making of the business. It's never won, right? But that was an inflection point. COVID hits. Post-COVID, it becomes government policy that every hospital in the country needs one of these systems. So we've gone from it's illegal to government mandating that every hospital has to have a patient engagement platform. And to watch that happen over the course of 10 years is, A, it's really exciting. And I'm super proud of our role in making that market and being the trailblazers. But if you're still in, I'm a hyper innovator who's breaking rules to make things happen mode, you can't also scale at like, you know, what was the government putting money in, formal tender processes. It's a different type of competitive environment. And so your question was like getting people internally to challenge you. If you haven't got the mindset internally to keep changing gears, you just can't respond to those different, very different environments you find yourself in.
Yeah, interesting. There's a framework called the SCARF framework, and it talks about people's motivators. And S stands for status, C is certainty, A is autonomy, R is relationships, and F is fairness. So what people are motivated by, where they feel safe and where they are disrupted. And that autonomy is really strong for you.
Yes.
Certainty, no thank you. You know, the relationships stand out as being really, really key.
Yeah.
But it's always a very interesting blend that actually within a team of people and how you describe your co-founders earlier and the people you're bringing in, to have a mix.
Yeah.
Because if everyone is happy with high autonomy, you're okay.
Yeah.
You know? But if everyone needs high levels of certainty, that also is a challenge. If everyone is motivated by that status and that recognition, then that's interesting. So it sounds like within the blend of people you've got, and as you bring people on, actually looking at some of them and actually how you pay attention to all of them, which brings a team, an ever-growing team, to be flourishing, you know, disrupting, as well as after that, bringing certainty, you know, building the relationships in which uncertainty can flourish is really key.
It is, absolutely. And I think in our founding team, what we didn't know, like, so, you know, we're still all operational in the business 12 years later. And I think that's really unusual for most businesses. If you look at us externally, if you've never met us before, three very different people.
Yeah.
Almost the deeper you dig, the more aligned we are.
Yeah.
And deep down, we share a very common sort of sense of fairness matters to all of us.
Yeah.
Very much. We all like autonomy.
Yeah.
We all have a real sense of fun.
Yeah.
And those things have kept us ultimately super aligned.
Yes.
I wish I could claim that was on purpose. It was luck. Yeah. but I find that really fascinating. Like what you sort of see on the surface isn't necessarily actually what drives people.
Yes.
And so we've got a genius combination of people with different skill sets, different ways of approaching a problem, but fundamentally aligned belief systems underneath. Yeah. And that's like, if you can find that, you're very lucky.
Well, yes, you are. But you're not lucky.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Maybe the luck's at the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, you had to cross paths with those people. As you said, they weren't necessarily friends before.
Yeah.
So there was some luck in that.
There was some luck in that.
And then everything else.
But there was a bit of making it as well, because we did, you know, we did pitch to each other, and we, you know, that those, the three of us chose each other for a reason.
Yeah.
I believe. And it was, it turns out it was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pleased about that. Very pleased.
Thanks, Casper.
You're welcome. We're going to go into some quickfire questions.
Okay.
You know, that's been an awesome uncovering of, you know, some of the thoughts, some of the ways that, you know, Dr. Doctor has gone from chopping onions, eating ice creams, you know, into, you know, serving so many people across, you know, 70 NHS hospitals, which has been fab. So I've got four questions. Who or what, but who or what inspires you?
I'm inspired by change. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's an individual I could point to that inspires me.
Yeah.
I would say most of my heroes are fictional.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the curiosity we spoke about earlier comes from reading fiction.
So yeah.
People often think that I'm talking about nonfiction books. Mm-hmm. But I like reading stories.
Okay.
Because I think when you read a book, you get to like see the world through someone else's eyes.
Yeah.
And that gives you perspective that you can't find anywhere else. So I wouldn't choose a real life individual.
Yeah.
But I would say I'm inspired by stories and narrative.
Any particular book that you feel has been inspirational, or, you know, that narrative you've taken?
This is like really cliched, but so much of my life has been inspired by reading Swallows and Amazons when I was a kid, and making my dad take me to the sailing club.
Yes.
That was, you know, I read that book and I was like, come on, take me to Frensham Pond, take me to Frensham Pond, take me to Frensham Pond. And that kicked my life off in a direction that it wouldn't have gone otherwise. And I wouldn't be the person I was without it.
You would not be the person without that book. I know it. What would be your best piece of advice for aspiring entrepreneurs?
Go and talk to as many people as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. Because people are so willing to help.
Yeah.
So willing to help. It's really flattering to be asked for help. Mm-hmm. And most successful people, if you ask them for 5 minutes, they'll probably give it to you.
Yeah.
Do that. Challenge yourself as to whether or not it's something you really want to do, you know, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
Incredibly rewarding. I wouldn't want to do anything else with my life. Mm-hmm. But it isn't for everyone.
Yeah.
So go and talk to people and challenge yourself on it. Yeah, it's amazing how much you can validate before you do anything else. I think people think you need to go and write a pitch deck first.
Yeah.
Nonsense. Don't do that. And definitely don't raise money first.
Okay.
Validate your idea, get a bit of traction, and then go and find a great funder. Mm-hmm. But it's that way round. It's not raise the money first and then try and work out what you're doing with it. So talk to as many people as you possibly can.
And finishing off, maybe that was it, but what's your guiding principle or a personal mantra?
I think it's been woven through this, which is stay curious. Mm-hmm. Stay curious. I think the day you stop being curious is the day that you know, you've retired and you go and sort of just go and lie down somewhere. I keep
not sure where.
Yeah, exactly. But like, be curious about things and stay interested, because the world is full of fascinating stuff, and you can go and build an app in 20 minutes using AI now. The only barrier between innovation and change and people is how curious they are and whether or not they're brave enough to go and try it. So, curiosity.
Let's go. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a superb conversation with you.
No worries, Casper. Lovely to see you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What an engaging chat with Tom. He first came to Tenzing to speak at the Altitude Academy team training about his experience as CEO of Being Invested In. He connected with the team with his balance of people and process, diligence of the firm and diligence of the people. And once again, the conversation came to building a high performance team. If you enjoyed listening to that conversation and want to hear more inspiring stories, then you can search Tenzing wherever you get your podcasts from. We'd love you to rate and review this episode. Please don't forget to subscribe. You can find out more about us on tenzing.pe, on LinkedIn, or on Instagram. Bye for now.